Real College Podcast is presented by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and is a production of Radio K.
This is Real College Podcast, and I'm your host, Nathan Fervoy. Just a few weeks ago, some Radio K folks set out to Chicago, Illinois for the three-day Pitchfork Music Festival, which hosts some of the most critically acclaimed alternative, indie, and hip-hop artists out, creating a dreamlike lineup for music fans from all over. Music reporter Lizzie Ritchie set out to get a glimpse of the festival chaos while pioneering Pitchfork for her very first time. Chicago!
Good evening, y'all.
It feels like every Pitchfork, there's just like those couple magic moments that you always wait for, and they always hit you like in a really deep spot. And Robin, definitely one of those moments.
I don't know, I got really worried that I wasn't going to, like, today was going to be canceled, and then it wasn't, and I got to see two of my favorite artists of all time, Charlie and Robin, and dance so hard with my friends, and it feels like today was tailor-made for me. I loved it so much.
With Charlie XCX and Robin finishing off the final night of Pitchfork, the crowd was left in awe of the magicalness of it all. You can read reviews and articles of what acts performed those nights, and even hear what specific songs. Maybe even catch glimpses of it through videos and pictures posted on social media. But it is an entirely different experience being intimate with the chaos and turbulent energy ever so present on the grounds during this festival. This is Lizzie Ritchie bringing to you a little slice of that energy from Pitchfork 2019.
I think in a good, interesting way, I went to the record fair, and that was, like, absolutely brilliant. I've never seen so many, like, rare CDs and tapes and records and stuff. So people are like very much enjoying themselves, which makes me happy. And I think there are just interesting outfits going on all around, like a good interesting. Everyone's really showing off some cool personal style. I like it.
To no surprise, the crowd that Pitchfork draws is a perfect mix of DIY kids and adults who either have the money to do nice and chic DIY outfits or even the ones who just like to thrift and work with what they got.
What am I wearing? Yeah. I am wearing a bunch of shit that I bought at a thrift store, and I don't know who made it at all. And that's kind of what makes it cool, right?
This is all thrifted in different areas. This was thrifted in LA. This was thrifted in Chicago.
I am wearing a shirt I bought on Craigslist and then these Death Trader shorts.
I have three earrings. One is a jewel pod. The other is a Mew, like a Pokemon. And then the third one is a Tamagotchi.
Crowds of people wearing the coolest outfits flooded the park. One of the more packed shows that was highly anticipated was Skyfarer and her first performance in years. There was a long wait before she came out onto stage, and unfortunately when she did, her in-ear monitor started malfunctioning. She graciously kept going and still gave a great performance, but her fans were very upset for her.
I also just have to say, Skyfarer was very wonderful. She was perfect, except their sound guy just kept screwing her over so bad, and I was very upset because I had been waiting to see that show for like 7 years.
Yeah, I feel bad that I did not bring her up initially because I'm still in shock that I literally got to see Skyfarer live.
Yeah.
She like just embodies so many really important things that I feel like for a lot of people our age felt in their teens and continue to feel.
It would have without a doubt been my number one favorite if it weren't for how bad they done her dirty.
Yes.
With that sound.
Yes.
Yeah,
she looked very upset, and I felt very bad for her, and it kind of broke my heart. I'm not going to lie, she didn't even get to say goodbye to us. They cut her off, like, before she could say anything. I was very sad.
Skyfarer's audio was probably the low of the festival for most people, even with the sudden rainstorm on Saturday. Pitchfork had to temporarily close, waiting for the storm to pass. They announced during the middle of Parquet Court's set that everyone had to get out in the park in the next 20 minutes. It was clear skies at the time, but only moments later did the clouds roll in and it downpoured. Most left, but there were some that stuck around in hopes that they could wait it out.
I mean, we just hung around. We were told multiple times to leave and we just kind of ignored them. We moved from tent to tent to hide from the rain, and the rain pretty much cleared up and it was sunny, but they told us we had to leave anyway and that the whole like festival was closed. So there were a bunch of people hanging out by the front gate entrance. And then finally they were like, all right, we're going to let people back in. And it was a very slow process. Like, they had to recheck everyone. They didn't ask for tickets, so I think a lot of people snuck in through, like, the re-entry.
It seems to be that for most people, it ended up being a positive change in plans. Some got to go home and snack, some got to come in for free, and others were just reminded of how badly they wanted to be there.
I feel like music festivals are like kind of a chore. You're like there for 8 hours and you're like, I barely want to see a song anymore. But you get evacuated and then you go back in and you're like, I am so lucky for every second of this music and I love it here and this is so much fun.
Pitchfork has always seemed to have drawn very chaotic, good energy, with many surprise performances like Snail Mail and Claro doing a duet together, or even Whitney bringing almost the entirety of Sunday's lineup on stage with them. People from all over the country attend, and you even have little run-ins with other musicians who are there as attendees.
What happened at Charlie was, first of all, I had a great time. Second of all, I saw Sir Baby Girl dancing right behind me, and I think they're very cool. And since this is for Radio K, I think all the listeners will also think they're very cool.
Pitchfork grounds at Union Park have a daily capacity for 20,000 people, also with people coming from all over the country every year. It is no surprise that lots of other artists also come out to see the music and their friends play. Going forward, I hope Pitchfork continues to stay close to home with lineups that are at the forefront of up-and-coming music, along with having influential artists. This has been Lizzie Ritchie with Radio K's Pitchfork coverage for 2019.
Stick around until the end of the episode to hear more from our Pitchfork 2019 coverage. As the firestorm that is the next election cycle approaches, it's clear that one main political issue will be climate change and how candidates plan on addressing it. Producer Matt McDonald and I went out into the Cedar Riverside neighborhood to pick the brains of our neighbors and hear how climate change is affecting local lives.
I haven't felt anything like noticeable, but you hear about what it's actually doing.
It being a hot July day, the response from many was along the lines of the obvious, it's too hot, and the AC costs more.
Like it was 100 degrees for the last 2 weeks. And that's too hot, man.
But there was also those whose work had been disrupted by fluctuations in weather and a city parks worker who explained that prolonged high temperatures had killed off fish in some ponds.
And more recently, we've been noticing a lot of like fish kill happening because of the change in temperatures.
Most expressed some frustrations at the uncertainty of what to do, and some turned the question back around on us.
It affects me because I know that I've got no future for our grandchildren. Realistically, you guys should be the ones that really have a dismal outlook. I'm 51. How does climate change going to affect you?
Yeah, what do you have to
That's
say
a good question because I'm asking. I'm very serious. Don't keep it. Keep it on. Here you go.
Well,
After a few hours in Cedar Riverside talking to passersby about climate change, Matt and I just so happened to cross paths with Dr. Kenny Blumenfeld, a character with ample experience talking climate change with strangers.
My name is Kenny Blumenfeld. I am a professional climatologist. I do work for the state of Minnesota, but I am here tonight on my own time.
Kenny's current talk at the Bryant Lake Bowl, entitled "But It Was Cold Last Week," deals explicitly with, quote, "the common sins against climatology that arise in normal conversation." As someone who frequently engages in conversation about climate change, we asked if he had any tips to share.
Honestly, in having a lot of these conversations, they're pretty emotionally charged. I, for whatever reason, am the kind of person who doesn't want to hurt someone's feelings. I don't like alienating people. And I've actually found that to be pretty handy in a lot of the work that I do, because we can just talk about what's going on with the weather. But by just kind of keeping it simple and maybe not talking about light bulbs and cars that people drive and who they voted for, and just starting with the facts, I've been able to keep a lot more people in the conversation.
If we take this advice and apply it to our own lives, it might be worth asking, who are we keeping in the conversation exactly? Frankly, after decades of debate on the topic, is it worth spending precious time continuing the conversation with those few who still deny the fact of climate change? Every last individual's support is not required to make headway on the issue. And from our pull of the street, it seems clear that most have some awareness of climate change and its negative effects at this point. However, as these effects set in, more than an awareness is needed. The conversation around climate change needs to move from is it real or not, to what are we going to do about it?
Achieve that. I think right now where my generation and older generations are completely stuck is that we have assumed that, you know, cars, we need cars. We have to heat our homes. We have all these things, and maybe we do need those, but we're not actually discussing how we're going to accomplish that. And of course,
in our current polarized political climate, it's from this debate that certain voices might be excluded.
It's kind of been really gratifying to have conversations with people who I think would often be excluded from these conversations, or maybe they would even opt out of them because there's too many sort of political hot button issues that come up, and it becomes too personal.
I am Tiana Medor. I am president of Students for a Conservative Voice.
Students for a Conservative Voice represent a group of young Republicans who claim to be, quote, changing the waves of Republican stereotypes.
A lot of, the polarized, outspoken voices, generally when they hear Republican, they associate that with someone who does not believe climate change is a thing. And something that has become very prominent in our student group and on our staff is this new wave of conservatives who, you know, we also incorporate progressive ideas into our beliefs. So we may be very, very, very conservative fiscally, economically. We may support Trump, but when it comes to climate change and whatnot, we tend to separate from the greater part of the Republican Party because we don't really see eye to eye with that stereotypical view.
For Tiana, the feeling is that polarized politics have gotten caught up on the old debate of if climate change is real or not. With the senior generation of Republicans still banking on the it's not real side, the what to do about it debate is occurring only on the left, excluding any young Republicans with an opinion on climate policy from the conversation.
So a lot of the ideas on the left, like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and all of that, in her Green Deal, whatever that whole shindig is, there's a lot of clauses in it that's stating, you know, the government's going to pay for it, yada, yada, yada. And that is something that Republicans don't resonate with, so then they divide from that party. But then they're also stuck with their party, who the people who are in office are not thinking of these alternative market ideas to fix the problem. So they kind of get taken out of the equation because they aren't resonating with the left because they have other ideological issues with the left, but they aren't really resonating with their leaders on the right either because there's kind of this middle ground and they kind of get shut out of the equation.
Are there any tips or just methods that you've come up with? What this means for the climate debate here on campus is that the conversation doesn't get very far.
I came to the realization at least on campus when, you know, everyone cheated about their politics. I kind of tend to just, you know, I inquire about people's view. I say, hey, what do you think? What's your opinion? I just kind of graze over the top. I don't really get into it because at the end of the day, I mean, you can only be shut down so many times. You start to feel kind of excluded entirely.
Of course, the sort of holy grail, the thing that everyone's hoping happens, is that we find a way to fly across the world, to drive around the country, to have a home in Minnesota that's heated throughout the winter and then cooled during the summer, somehow without emitting any greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. And right now people are saying, you figure it out. That's too hard for us. But we're sure because you guys are smart and entrepreneurial and haven't, you know, carried around the emotional and mental baggage that we've carried around, that you'll be able to do it.
Right now, the world seems to be looking to the youth for a solution to the massively complex problem of climate change, a problem which Students for a Conservative Voice believes will require serious inquiry and debate.
We need open discourse. We need to have these discussions between the right and the left. We need to have a sense of openness because we can't have polarity.
Thank you for talking to us today, sharing this vast knowledge. Is there anything else you'd like to say?
Well, good luck with everything. And, you know, if you do decide to take on the biggest problems facing humanity, be sure to ask for help.
Last month, a convention here in the theater section of the U's Minneapolis campus brought together a mysterious group of individuals from the very fringes of society. The chance to interact with more of their kind brought scores of puppeteers out the woodwork and into the podcast studio's vicinity. Producer Ben Hallam went to investigate what exactly goes on at such a convention.
I have a business called Planet of the Puppets at the Pike Place Market, where I sell pop-up puppets and kits to make the pop-up puppets all year round for the last 15 years. And I also live at the Pike Place Market, where I have a studio where I do commission work for parades, fairs, festivals, ballet, opera, YouTube videos, music videos, a little of everything.
That's Rob Bjark, a workshop presenter at the National Puppetry Festival, held earlier this July at the University of Minnesota. When I was talking to Rob, I started by asking him about the difference between his daily life as a puppeteer and the community he finds at the National Puppetry Festival. Here's Rob.
It's basically a commitment to poverty, but I enjoy poverty, so I'm not you know, the average person. I like mac and cheese and top ramen. I don't recommend it for the weak of heart or the weak of spirit because it's a demanding job. And when you're self-employed, sometimes your boss can be kind of a jerk. Well, there's 15 million people a year go through the Pike Place Market, and when I show them a pop-up puppet, they don't know what to think of it because they're not puppeteers, and so it usually disarms and surprises them, usually makes them laugh, or if they think I'm particularly weird, they get out of my way. So either way, I win. But in puppetry, everybody's just as weird as I am, so it's a much more accepting community. So no matter what the age of the person or whether they're, you know, from this country or another country, everybody here kind of has a common thread and something that we all get along with. And basically, I think we're the envy of the modern world because we can all get along with each other.
Though the performances and workshops might be interesting and informative, almost everyone I spoke to, like Rob, said they came to the festival for the community. Gordon Smooter, a Minneapolis puppeteer, described this communal aspect of the festival when I spoke with him. A quick note, I spoke to Gordon while he was working at the puppet store, so there might be some noise in the background.
I come to the festival to interact with other puppeteers, to meet new puppeteers, and so being in the store version, or the store part of the festival, everybody comes here, so I get a chance to pretty much meet everybody when they come in. Well, like I say, I like meeting new people. And expanding, you know, the folks that I know within the puppetry realm, because puppeteers tend to work fairly isolated. And so, you know, we all work at home in the quiet of our little homes, and maybe we go out and do a show or something. But there, you know, aside from being on the internet, you don't really have a lot of interaction with other puppeteers on a one-to-one basis. So the festival is a great place to actually get together with folks, sit down, have a cup of coffee, and talk to each other about your experiences and educate each other.
These connections formed at national puppetry festivals are a big part of what helps keep the puppetry profession alive. Because puppeteers work in such isolated conditions, getting into the profession can be intimidating. It can be hard to meet people, and hard to learn whether your goals are really achievable. Stacy Gordon, now a board member for the Puppeteers of America, shared her story of how one puppetry festival in 2007 changed her life and set her on the path to professional puppetry.
So my first puppet festival that I came to was in Minneapolis in 2007, and it was probably one of the most significant life-changing events that I took part in. I forged friendships, I made acquaintances, professional acquaintances, I met people that I'd only ever heard of through books and the internet. I met my mentor, I've met some of my best friends, and I got to see that this was an achievable thing for me to do. So the coolest thing about that is now I work in television. Now I get to share in that same world through one of my best friends who I met 12 years ago at that festival in 2007. I can't express how much being part of this organization has changed my life. I would not be doing what I am doing today, which is a full-time professional puppeteer, if it weren't for the Puppeteers of America. Some of the best moments, yes, the shows are mind-blowing and the talks are inspirational, and seeing our generations that have come before us, and understanding the significance that we're part of a legacy and we're standing on the shoulders of giants. Some of my favorite moments are in the wee hours when you're just hanging out with each other and you're with your people.
It's these moments of connection at the National Puppetry Festival and regional festivals around the country that help make real what so many attendees told me. Puppetry is not a dying art. Even as the media landscape is increasingly competitive and divided, leaving puppetry with a fraction of the market share it may have once commanded, so long as people keep coming to these national puppetry festivals and keep being inspired by the work they see others doing and the friendships they create with experienced puppeteers and mentors, then puppetry will continue growing, evolving, and expanding. For Rio College Podcast, I'm Ben Hatton.
Now more from Pitchfork Music Festival. In this portion, Darby Ottison and Lizzie Ritchie talk to Lily West of the band La 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 about their art and Pitchfork experience.
La 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 is a Chicago-based indie band started by Lily West, a singer-songwriter originally from London. Their debut album, Sleepyhead, was put out in 2016, quickly followed by The Lamb in 2018. Having originally come to Chicago for her education at the Chicago Art Institute as a visual artist, she quickly found herself gravitating towards the music scene and began her journey with music there. This being her home turf, we sat down with her to ask a little bit about her own experiences at Pitchfork.
I'm Lily West from La 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 La.
Cool. So we're here at Pitchfork, so I thought we'd just start off chatting about that for a little bit. Who are you most excited to see, or who were you most excited to see in this lineup?
I was really excited to see the Chicago locals. I was really excited to see Tasha, who just played. It's really good. I'm also a really big Eamon Dunes fan, so I'm excited for his set. And then, you know, I'm really interested in seeing Charlie XCX and Robin.
The best part of Pitchfork is that there's always something going on. Even in the quietest corners of the grounds where we are doing our interview, you can still hear attendees shouting in the background. Later that night, Charlie XCX and Robin played and closed out the festival with a big bang. To add to the fun, Charlie XCX brought out Cupcake to sing their song Lip Gloss, and the crowd lost their minds.
Cupcake came out, and I freaked out. I screamed so hard. I didn't know my lungs could do that.
Throughout the weekend, it became fairly common for bands to bring out other artists on stage. Lily West even joined Grape Tooth, another Chicago-based band, up on stage, and together they sang an unreleased track.
I really remember writing was Fuck With Your Friends from the album Sleepyhead, and it really just sort of fell out of me, and I was like really confused by it because I'd never done it before. I was like, I think that this is a song. I'm not sure if this is like a format or something. I don't know.
From how she has grown as a musician, it's interesting that her exploration of music began with her stumbling upon songwriting and then prospered from there. We asked her a bit about that transition as an artist and what that was like for her.
Yeah, I think that what's interesting about the transition is that I don't really make visual art anymore. Like, it feels like maybe it's scratching the same itch. So that's interesting about it. And as far as perception goes, it's just, I think that music is the most easily consumed art form. So, you know, more people see it. And I think it's, in some ways, easier to connect with, I think.
And she's totally right. I mean, that's why so many people come out to Pitchfork every year, and from all over the country, too. Music is what brings people together and quite literally moves people.
Where's your hometown?
It's Seattle, Washington. We came for my very good friend Derek's birthday, and he used to live here for a long time, and he really loves Pitchfork, so he brought us here to celebrate. It's the right way to celebrate his birthday.
Where's your hometown?
San Antonio. Yeah, we saw the same shows. I really want to see La La La, La La La.
Yeah, all the Laws.
Yeah, all the Laws. They're really good.
Her popularity has grown from her last album, The Lamb, that received great reviews from Pitchfork itself, and also publications like Fader and Stereo Gum. So her being able to draw crowds from all over the country is no surprise. Her fluidity as an artist and with self-expression is what made us want to ask her about what is in store for her music and sound in the future.
I mean, it's always up in the air, and I'm always open to it moving and changing, but I think that I'm definitely moving a little bit more of an electronic direction, not like totally techno or anything. I'm just becoming more interested in that kind of sound, and I'm trying to have a little more fun. But I'm still writing pretty sad songs sometimes. I mean, I would love to collaborate with Charlie XCX and Robin, but it's not really in the realm of possibility.
With Lily from La 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 wanting to lead more into electronic style music, I would love to get all three of them in a room together and see what they would create. The rest of Sunday night certainly was not a quiet one. It was the night with possibly the most energy and craze to it, and I only expect bigger and better for next year at Pitchfork. This has been Lizzie Ritchie, signing off.
That's all for this episode. Real College Podcast is a production of Radio K. It's produced by Ben Hallam, Lizzie Ritchie, and Tosin Fasimo. I'm Nathan Fervoy, your host and managing editor. All episodes of Real College Podcast can be found online at radiok.org or on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Follow us on Instagram at Real College Podcast. Thanks for listening.